you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Alas, the story is no longer new. U.S. jobs getting lost to automation, offshoring, to counter the ever higher cost of hiring an American, Obamacare merely being the latest cost on top of paid family leave act here in California, New Jersey, and being talked about expanding nationwide, workers' comp, disability, Social Security, American Disabilities Act, so on. The labor participation rate is the lowest on record. Lowest percentage on record. As a result, I've been devoting a number of shows to this. I call it the work topic of our era. The key is, what will happen next, and what can we do about it as a society and as individuals? I mean, the consensus among, I probably had a half dozen guests discussing this already, is that looking backward, technology advances eventually created more jobs. I mean, after all, the ending of the buggy whip was replaced by lots and lots and lots of car jobs. But the consensus among people in 2013, 2014, among the experts at least that I've spoken to on the show and been reading about, is that this time, alas, it will be different thanks to good old Moore's Law, technology increasing the speed every 2 years of processors. And we're becoming an ever more silicon society, a digital society. I was in the, you know, in the agricultural and manufacturing era, there were still always needs for lots of jobs. But today, the big companies, the companies that are having the most net worth, the Googles, the Apples, the Amazons, they end up needing to hire a relatively small number of people because a piece of software is essentially almost self-generating. It takes one person to push a button, not millions of people to harvest some more corn or to manufacture another widget. So, and as a perhaps the most important manifestation of that digitization, of that siliconization of the world, is, to use another gerund, the roboticization of everything from driver, that is car, truck, train, plane, droneless delivery, as an example of that, to retail clerk, IBM having developed an automated retail clerk to replace that very often inept $10 an hour person, from barista, they're developing automatic bartenders, replacing all those people who supposed, you know, being a bartender was supposed to be your base level job that you could count on if you got nothing else. Even that is at risk, to accountant. At the same time as the United States government is dramatically, as I said, raising the cost of hiring an American. And so the consensus among the people who have been guests on this show over the last 6 months on this topic is that it will cause a permanent reduction in jobs. And alas, as I said, signs of that are already here, not just from the oft-cited in the last few months statement that the labor participation rate is the lowest in recorded history. But the liberal, and, you know, we tend to dismiss the conservative or libertarian reports, but the Liberal Economic Policy Institute reported this week that long-term unemployment is the highest on record. Continuing the exploration here on Work with Marty Nemko, what's to come in this world of work or non-work, I have Dr. Andrew McAfee. He is a principal research scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business, a part of MIT's famed Sloan School of Business. More specifically, Germaine, he is the author of a new book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Andy McAfee, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure indeed. Well, the book asserts at least that short-term, if not long-term, technology will eliminate many jobs. Other than those that I kind of ticked off, what are some potent and maybe even best surprising examples?
Well, where we see technology having its greatest effect now, and in a way this is unfortunate, is right there in the middle of the American workforce, because the median American worker, that person right at the 50th percentile, is not doing manual labor, but they're also not doing incredibly high-end thinking work. They're doing what you might call fairly routine information processing. And that is the stuff that computers are already pretty good at and getting better at all the time. So one profession that's under a bit of stress these days is good old-fashioned tax preparer, who's a person who's been in your neighborhood for a long, long time. Now, increasingly, we are turning to programs like TurboTax, which gives you really good advice suitable for a lot of different situations and costs much less than $100. This is tough to compete with.
I can't believe you mentioned that. It's a perfect example. When I was younger, I used to go to my local neighborhood accountant who did my taxes. Then when TurboTax came out, and especially when it got less buggy, I used to, in the intermediate stage, use TurboTax to do a first draft of my taxes and then take it to my accountant for his blessing. Now, because he has given his blessing often enough, I don't even use that. So that is, certainly I can suddenly completely relate to. Continue.
And think about that example for a minute, because that shows just both the good news and the bad news of the situation that we're heading into. It's really good news for people like you who get their taxes done more conveniently, more quickly, much more cheaply than they did in the past.
Yep.
It's also good news for Scott Cook and his team at Intuit, who, because they generated a huge amount of value, are capturing a huge amount of value. Good for them. The bad news is for that person who invested a lot of their human capital in learning the U.S. tax code, went to school, became a CPA, played by the rules, did the right thing, and are now finding themselves probably looking around for clients because folk like Marty Nemko aren't showing up there anymore.
That's exactly right. I want to hear more examples. I think that really should be the primary focus of our show today. You know, it's very easy for those of us who have advanced degrees and maybe whose friends are not in the, in the struggle, let's call it the struggling class, for us to talk about what's going to be ahead for us. But if we are at all egalitarian, the notion is there are 337 million people in the United States, by definition of which, half of which are, quote, below average. They are not rocket science thinkers. They do not have bachelor's degrees. They may have drug problems. They may have mental health problems. They may simply, because of genetic or environmental reasons, may not be the most motivated people in the world. They may have annoying personalities, which I have been known to be accused of having. And so those folks are not going to be the ones who are hired by Google to develop the next algorithm for its search engine. What the core thing that I'm going to want to talk through much of our interview is, what the hell is going to happen to that 167 million people who are not going to be analyzing big data. So, but first let's not rush ahead of ourselves. What's another example of something under our noses that perhaps isn't so obvious, where digitization, siliconization is mitigating jobs in a not transient way, but in a structural permanent way?
So we started right there in the archetypal middle of the workforce. Let's go down a little bit and talk about a customer service agent, which is an entry-level job, has been available to a lot of people. You don't need rocket science IQ. You don't need extremely advanced interpersonal skills. It's not the most thrilling job in the world. You sit on the phone and deal with customers all day, but it's been a source of employment. Now, we think a lot about outsourcing those customer service jobs to other English-speaking countries, the Philippines, India, places like that. What's increasingly happening, though, is that we're using software to do the work of customer service. And there's a really interesting progression that goes on. I've come across a couple different stories in the news because reporters notice that they seem to be getting canned responses in perfect American-accented English when they called up their cable company, their phone company, their sewer bill, whatever, to try to get some customer service help. The answers they got weren't bad, but they seemed really, really prescripted. And then they dug a bit farther, and they learned that for some companies, they employ Filipinos who have very good English abilities, but accented English, to sit there and listen to what we're saying and then push the button that will spit back the perfectly pre-recorded American English response to people.
Wow.
So that's an example of offshoring facilitated by technology. What's happening now, though, is that we're getting the person out of the loop altogether, and there's an algorithm that listens to what the human being wants and then decides which of the perfect pre-recorded speech files to serve back to them.
Absolutely.
Now, no human in that loop, aside from the person who initially recorded the response, and with voice synthesis getting better all the time, I don't know how much longer that's going to be the case.
Absolutely. Well, that's with voice recognition. Obviously, it has replaced directory assistance for well over half our calls. Every time you call directory assistance for a phone number, the default is the automatic version of it. And, of course, when you mention the word close to home, I was just thinking about my life. How, in the last 5 years, how have I interacted with something that used to be a human being that isn't a person? Well, obviously, there's the ATMs. Think of how many fewer bankers are needed thanks to ATMs, and most of us are grateful. We don't really feel like having small conversations with them. And of course, now in the supermarket, ubiquitous is self-checkout. And most people opt for self-checkout, even though they've got to bag their own groceries, they got to look up the code for the fruit. More, the lines actually are now longer on the self-checkout line than in the cashier in the supermarket. So people are voting with their feet to opt for essentially the eradication of their own, of jobs.
And let's go up a little bit in the skills ladder, the education ladder. Law is under a lot of pressure these days. Mm-hmm. Law school graduates are facing a really dismal job market, mm-hmm. especially if they don't come from the absolute top skills. There are a number of reasons for that. One of them is the fact that whereas we used to employ, gymnasiums full of lawyers to sit around and read documents and look for patterns, as part of the discovery process, there's now a pretty popular category of software called e-discovery
yep.
that says, give me digital versions of all those documents, tell me what you're looking for, tell me what would make a smoking gun here, and I'll spit you back all kinds of patterns and conclusions you can draw. It's tough to tell how good that stuff is versus that old-fashioned army of lawyers in a gymnasium reading boxes full of documents. Some of the indications we get, though, are that e-discovery does at least as good a job as that human army.
Well, there'll be no question that as a first screen for those, instead of those literally rooms full of bankers' boxes worth of data to be reviewed, that keyword searches, smart algorithms is going to do a great first cut at identifying potentially key data points that then a much smaller number of individual lawyers will then use to make the final determinations. Again, the bottom line is jobs are going to be lost. What shocks me in your book, by the way, which is I'm talking to Andrew McAfee. He is the author of the book The Second Machine Age: Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. He is principal research scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business, part of MIT's Sloan School of Business. But I really do want to talk about solutions, of course. But I'm just humanly, I don't know if it's Schadenfreude, which is this some weird kind of taking kind of weird fascination, not quite pleasure, in seeing this dramatic transformation. Your book talks about that even soldiers and cooks and even teachers are at risk of losing jobs permanently. Tell us about that.
Now, what's interesting about those three professions, because I think if they're going to be displaced, it's going to be a lot farther down the road, a lot farther, because those three professions stress things where we humans still have the upper hand. A soldier has to operate in the physical world over a lot of different terrain. They've got to make a ton of decisions, very high-stakes decisions, about how to do their job. Robots are still fairly lousy at walking across a room, let alone up a hill, let alone through a forest. Cooks work in an intensely physical environment. They use all their senses. They work very quickly. They have great manual dexterity. Robots are still fairly lousy at all those things. And teachers, when they're doing their jobs well, they are motivating students. They are navigating this really rich interpersonal environment. They're keeping kids on track. They're keeping them focused. Keeping a room full of kids on track, I've never seen a computer by itself that could do that. So while we do talk about those kinds of professions, those aren't in the short term under a lot of direct pressure from technology, I don't think.
Andy, I want to push back on all three.
Okay.
Let's take soldiers. We have already, a decade ago, we had the mine dismantlers used in Cambodia, etc. Of course, there's going to be need for some soldiers who are making individual decisions to, climb up hills and when to shoot and when not to, of course. But there is much routine work in soldiering that will, at least some of that will be replaced. Cooks, right now, if I remember correctly, it was both in Holland and in Japan, there already are automated fast food makers and servers. For example, a sushi maker. There's an automated sushi maker that works in fast food sushi restaurants in Japan. And 50 years ago, there were automated self-serves. There was in a chain in New York called the Horn and Hard Art, called an automat, where people would go in and there were no waiters or waitresses. There were simply little windows with the food there. But perhaps most interesting and is more in my own wheelhouse of expertise is education. You know, we well know, and you know, whether it be from kindergarten through graduate school, that some teachers are magnificent masters of transforming students from indifferent to knowledge to fascinated, from ignorant of principle to experts at principle. But there is a normal distribution of those folks, and some, real to use a technical term, suck. Whereas if we had an online interactive video-based instruction taught by the most transformative instructor, let's say for calculus, and that was then made available across the nation or across the world, the cost of that highly developed interactive video could be amortized across all the kids, and there could be far lower trained, lower cost paraprofessionals to provide that classroom management that you describe. So I would argue that the siliconization of even things like soldiering, cooks, and teachers are at more near-term risk than you implied. Do you disagree?
I disagree a bit with that. Soldiering, for example, you mentioned setting off mines, and one of the main uses for somewhat autonomous vehicles right now is dismantling IEDs in Iraq and Afghanistan. It turns out right now you need at least three soldiers on the other end of that thing to make it work. It's primarily there to protect our troops, not to make them more productive. A drone aircraft has about, I did not realize this until recently, has about 100 people on the back end of it. So it's not currently about productivity in the military, it is about protecting the troops.
Stand corrected.
You mentioned cook, and there we are seeing some of the things that you describe. Burger flipper is our current shorthand for this job of last resorts. Well, there's a robot now that will make 360 completely customized burgers an hour. So, for some of the more routine kinds of manual work, that's where we're going to see the encroachment of technology first. For the cooks that I watch, the guys that I know in the restaurant industry, I'm not concerned about their job in the short to medium term, because they're working in an extremely dynamic, fluid environment, and what they do is pretty close to magic for me.
Fair enough. How about the teacher example where I was most fervent?
Yeah, and what you describe is already taking place in education.
Right.
We do have the absolute rock stars at lots of different levels, digitizing their materials, digitizing the assessment tools, and serving them out, in many cases, for free around the world. It's a fantastic development for the students. What we're learning so far, though, is that those are not yet a complete substitute for a classroom. Like you say, maybe we're heading into a world where there's someone with a different skill set, more on the guiding and motivating kids, less on the mastery of the subject matter. Maybe we're heading there, but again, for the short to medium term, I see and I want a lot of teachers in my society.
Andy, I think we are on the cusp of radical change. Professor Hassan Pfeffer, who may be some brilliant professor at MIT or Harvard, still is usually, it's orthogonal. His ability or her ability may be brilliant, but not. There's too great a disparity between his mind and that of the typical students. There is going to be a new cohort of instructors who have the art of transforming undergraduate students and students. Right now, the course completion rate of online courses is nightmarishly bad.
Yep.
And that's because of who's teaching, because it is still relatively static, it is still relatively auditory and very simple in its visual. But to the extent with greater bandwidth available in most people's computers, there's going to be far more immersive, simulation-centric instruction guided by a transformational teacher who will not have a PhD from MIT, because that, by definition, makes his way of thinking so different from that from the students that it creates too great a barrier. I believe that when we replace the PhD with somebody who has that gift of being able to transform students who are normal, regular students, and include gamification and include simulation and videoification and include and even something as kind of techniquey as three-dimensional holography, so the instructor feels like he's right there and fellow students feel like they're right there. That is going to be what's going to really eviscerate the live teacher as a competitor if the teachers unions will allow it. Do you want to push back on that?
Again, I think we're largely in agreement. We just don't know exactly how quick this is going to play out and what form it's actually going to take. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing to me is that we're seeing so much innovation and experimentation in areas like online teaching, in areas like delivering courses via technology. It may well play out the way that you describe, it may well not, but something really interesting is going to happen there. My point is that the edifice of education is not going to come tumbling down as we currently understand it in the next 3 to 5 years.
All right, fair enough. Now we're going to go back to the bottom half in a minute, but I'm blessed with, although I'm an atheist, I use that term, I don't know why I say, blessed, but we are fortunate here on NPR in San Francisco to have a very intelligent audience, and many of my listeners are the kind of people who will thrive in this very ever more demanding job market. And so let's talk for a moment about the growth in the high end areas in the siliconization of America or the world. What are some of the cooler, if you will, jobs that will be increasingly available for such folks?
Well, my favorite new job these days is data scientist, which is not just a statistician with a different business card, because the toolkit that you have to use to make sense out of these ridiculous quantities, this ocean of digital data that we have, the toolkit you need to be a master of is quite different than was the case 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So there's this new breed of geek that's appeared. They call themselves data scientists, and they've got this great combination of artificial intelligence chops, computer science chops, statistical chops, some new kind of applied math that's just been unveiled in the past generation, and they bring all these things together to work on very important and incredibly difficult problems, the kind of problems that have been vexing researchers for generations. We're now making really serious progress on.
Give an example of one of the kind of problems that they're addressing that might inspire us to pay homage to them more than we pay to our athletes and musicians and the like.
Diagnosing breast cancer is a great example.
You bet.
Pathologists have been doing that using their eyes, using the pattern recognition tools of their brains, using a fairly standard playbook for generations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a pathologist is an extremely highly trained medical specialist because you got to train that pattern recognition capability. It takes a long time. It's extraordinarily difficult to do well. And a while back, a team of geeks tried to digitize the work of a pathologist, and they basically showed the computer a bunch of breast cancer slides. They then told the computer what the outcomes for all the patients were, and they said, you figure out the correlations, which aspects of this image seem to be most closely related to the bad kinds of outcomes.
Right.
And the computer actually did a very good job. When they showed it a brand new set, it said, okay, this one, this one, this one, this one. And they were at least as good as the human pathologist at making that diagnosis. And it turns out the computer taught itself to look for features in the images that no human pathologist is currently trained at. That's the kind of innovation and breakthrough that makes me really optimistic going forward, because our digital tools are going to help us have better outcomes.
Well, first of all, I like to do this when I have about 1 out of 10 guests I'd say this to, because I feel we all are perhaps maybe a little too praised, but I love you as a guest. You are so verbal,
thank you,
so
Marty.
Smart,
I love you as a host.
Substantive and interesting, and I just like to give you credit where it's deserved. But your point, of course, leads to what has been the source of science fiction stories for millennia, which is the singularity, that you said the computer is teaching itself how to better diagnose breast cancer. Well, does that not lead to scenarios where, yes, there will be always a few people needed to program the computer, but if we create these self-replicating, self-enhancing computers, does that, what extent, lest we be guilty of being too much of a techno-optimist, what do you see as the risks of computers that are teaching themselves to be ever smarter? Will they be ever smarter than 99% of us to perhaps nefarious ends, or is that still the realm of science fiction even in the 20 to 50 year time frame?
I still find that the realm of science fiction. Now, you mentioned a 50-year time frame as your outside range.
Right.
Man, my brain does not work that far out. When I think about the progress that we're seeing right now and try to project that forward 50 years, honestly, my brain cramps up. I don't know where we're getting.
You're right. That's good.
But I am not that... I'm not that concerned about the singularity. And like you say, there are these two different versions of it. When computers become authentically intelligent instead of artificially intelligent, there's the happy version where we kind of merge with digital life and we create this one big global super brain, and it's kind of fantastic. And then there's the dystopian version, which we see in The Matrix and The Terminator and Battlestar Galactica, where the silicon-based life goes, hey, that carbon stuff is kind of annoying. Let's go declare war on it. I'm not that concerned about that flavor of it. When we talk to the geeks who are really pushing the envelope hard, and we ask them, man, are you replicating the human brain? Almost uniformly, they go, I have no idea how the human brain works.
Right.
So I'm not. I'm trying to solve a very tough computer science or engineering problem. The way I'm getting there is extremely unlikely to mimic what a human brain does. You ask what I am worried about on that farther out time frame. We are building an extraordinarily complex, tightly coupled digital infrastructure. Our stuff is all interconnected. It talks to each other. Some of the nodes are particularly important. That is ripe both for bad accidents and they're very tempting targets for the bad guys out there.
Absolutely.
And whenever I want to stay up all night, I read about cyber warfare and cyber terrorism, and it's terrifying stuff. So those are the real threats that we, longer-term threats that we need to have our eye on.
That makes perfect sense. Of course, the one that I think even eclipses that is bioterrorism.
Because the genome actually is just code, and we're learning how to manipulate that stuff. Who knows what the bad kind of geek is going to come up with?
Well, absolutely. I actually wrote a scenario that I tried to make as realistic as possible, and I won't go into too much detail, but just for interest's sake, and I ran it by somebody who is a very senior official at the Department of Homeland Security who said it's absolutely feasible. So I would just outline it for entertainment's sake. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. Then we're going to go back to career stuff. Of course, the greatest fear is a solo actor because they're the most difficult to detect. A solo actor happens to be a disgruntled biophysicist who's a specialist in infectious diseases. He creates a mutated version of smallpox. The worst kind of smallpox is highly virulent. He then goes on the long-term bus at a major international airport in a small little squeegee bottle in his pocket. He just with the nozzle facing out, he releases it onto the bus. He gets on the first stop and he releases this highly communicable mutated and therefore there's no vaccine biovirus onto the bus. So they're all infected. Then he's walking through the lobby as he's looking like a typical passenger. He's spraying more of this stuff. He then goes to the bathroom and drops the bottle down the toilet, and then he's still got some of the residue on his body, and he gets on a plane and then like any other passenger and then returns the next day or whatever. He said that could kill literally billions because there is no vaccine, and by the time of the incubation period it's already spread wildly, including places that don't have good public health. So that, what's your reaction to that one?
You know, that kind of thing has been the staple of sci-fi novels and movies for a while. I'm with that senior official you talked to. There's nothing about that sounds completely impossible to me.
So, yes, and that, of course, creates, I think there's nobody would argue that, back to the job front, that there isn't going to be a massive increase in the amount of jobs in all sorts of security, whether it's water security or bioterrorism or cybersecurity. That's a slam dunk. You agree?
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to need lots of jobs to kind of preserve and maintain our infrastructure of all kinds. You mentioned digital infrastructure, absolutely. But one of the things we try to say forcefully in the book is, look, if you want to promote economic growth and job growth, how about upgrading our current physical infrastructure in the country above its current grade of a D+. There's no excuse why our airports and ports and bridges and roads need to be in the shape that they're in. First world infrastructure is an investment in the country's future, and it's a great engine for economic growth. One of our immediate term recommendations is, why don't we fix that?
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Andrew McAfee. He is at MIT, in the MIT School of Business, and the author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. I'm happy to keep this conversation going if you've got a little more time. What do you think?
Yeah, let's go.
Good. So back still on the optimistic side, we were talking about the jobs that will be created. We talked about data scientists. We talked about cybersecurity as well as building infrastructure. What are some other jobs that are going to be likely burgeoning in this era of increased siliconization?
Well, we know, for example, that our population is graying. We know that the total healthcare burden on the country is going to go up, and to the extent there is good news there, I believe it's on the job front. People like nurses and home health aides and the different caregivers, they do work that is really, really hard to automate. They deal with patients. They elicit their symptoms. They listen to them. They make diagnoses of all different kinds. They put needles in people's arms. They wrap bandages. They take blood pressure. This is a bundle of skills, thankfully, that is very, very hard to automate right now.
You bet.
Now the geeks I know are chipping away at it, but the robotic home health aid that's not going to terrify human beings and is instead going to put them at ease, that's a long way away.
You bet. And, parallel examples in the healthcare space that are perhaps less obvious are things like dentist or occupational therapist or fitness trainer. But you also, we were talking a little bit about the high end, and again, I want to appeal to all segments of my listenership. You talk about, people who are writing mobile phone apps. You're talking about genetic counselors. You're talking about algorithm developers for Twitter. Talk about a couple of more of the, you're at MIT. What are a couple of the burgeoning careers that are not obvious for the geeks among us?
Well, entrepreneurship is on the rise among the kinds of students that I see at MIT. They want to do a computer science degree, maybe follow it up with an MBA, and then they want to go start something. The idea that they want to go be part of some large industrial-era company, that's so far in the rearview mirror that's not even funny. So we're going to see, we're going to continue to see a lot of high-tech entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
One of the other recommendations we make in the book, and this is a near-term recommendation, is why don't we make it as favorable an environment as possible for all kinds of entrepreneurs? So it's not just the kid starting up the next Snapchat or Instagram, but if someone wants to open up a car wash, that's going to employ some people. Let's make it as easy as possible for that. The challenging news there is that entrepreneurship in high tech is pretty fantastic. Entrepreneurship as a whole in America has been on a downward trend for a while. It's not a great sign. We need to reverse it, not because some entrepreneurs get rich and I love rich people, but because what entrepreneurs do as part of their work is create jobs and opportunities for others. We need more of that.
You say make it easier. What does that look like?
There are a couple things we can do. The regulatory burden seems to be a pretty big burden, and as the regulatory thicket gets deeper and deeper, and it exists at the federal, state, local, whatever level, that gets in the way. It can really impede someone from starting up a business. The other thing that we've seen from the research is that a lot of would-be entrepreneurs are reluctant to take the plunge because they don't know where their health coverage is going to come from, and that seems like a shame. And then finally, entrepreneurship in America is fueled by immigration and by immigrants to an extraordinary degree. As we make our immigration policies more and more kind of foreboding for people, we're heading in the wrong direction.
Well, you're implying that regulations need to be decreased. I mean, if one looks in any set, whether you're liberal or you're conservative, there is unarguable that the amount of regulation has absolutely burgeoned over decades, and in the name of environmental protection, in protecting investors, in ensuring worker rights, so that everybody, if I were to start a business and I want to hire somebody, I have enormous payroll costs and paperwork. I do have to provide Obamacare if I have 50 or more employees. I do have to have paid family leave. I do have to have paperwork for Social Security. I do have to have paperwork for disability. I have workers' comp. I have to defend against any lawsuits because that I'm not complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act. I do there is all kinds of grievances, absolutely legitimate, and some not, or racial and gender discrimination, wrongful termination. Is there any realistic scenario under which those protections are going to be dissipated. Or, I mean, I am a career counselor and I have a million clients and they're all daunted from starting a business, or they'll start under the radar and either off the books or just work by themselves because the thought of hiring even one person is absolutely prohibitive. Am I delusional in thinking, am I realistic in saying there's no way that those regulations are going to be rolled back in any way? They're going to be, if anything, we see expansion.
You know, the tendency of bureaucrats is to do what they do for a living, which is to write regulations. So I agree with you about the trend. I am hopeful, though, that if we decide as a that it's a national priority to foster entrepreneurship and to try to get out of people's way, that we can get that done. That makes me sound like a kind of a naive Pollyanna, but honestly, how many of us 5 years ago would have predicted marriage equality or legal marijuana in multiple states in the country? We can make decent, we can still make decent-sized changes.
Okay, let's now turn back to what is the one of the core topics of the year. We hear the word income equality, income inequality. We talk about the gap, the achievement gap, gap between rich and poor. Now let's, lest we be guilty of elitism and focusing on these smart people who are going to develop algorithms for Twitter, let's talk about what in the world is the wisest approach to what is going to happen to those 150 million plus people in the first percentile to the 50th percentile in education, in intelligence, in emotional well-being, in drive. There is, by definition, half of the people who are above average and half of the people who are below, notwithstanding Garrison Keillor's statement about Lake Wobegon, where everybody's above average. We are now in our eighth decade of a multi-trillion dollar spend on compensatory education. That is where we have bet almost all our chips. A little bit on job retraining, but the New York Times reported a few years ago that job retraining programs cost like $277,000 to train one person, and then for one job retraining, and then they didn't even hold their jobs for long. But we've bet on like Head Start like crazy, and indeed President Obama in the State of the Union reiterated wanting to expand Head Start, but the meta-evaluations of Head Start have shown that it makes no difference whatsoever over the long term. And we've long included a curriculum for decades, since I started out getting my PhD in education, where we talked about problem solving over rote learning. And yet to date, I look at charts constantly about the achievement gap. We have failed to even slightly close the achievement gap. In fact, it expands because ever more ability, technological, intellectual chops are required for today's well-paying jobs. What in the world are we going to do, especially now that the bottom half is not just competing with applicants in their community, but everywhere for so much work product is digitized, everywhere from Azerbaijan to Tel Aviv, Mumbai to Shanghai. What do you think, A, will happen to those 167 million human beings in America, not to mention the bottom half of the 7 billion worldwide, and what can we realistically and ethically and humanely do about it without eating our seed corn?
Well, let's keep in mind that people are not just one-dimensional entities, right? So we don't just have a single scale where half of us are above average and half of us are below average. There are lots of different dimensions toward being not only a person, but toward being a worker, a contributor to the economy. They're not all based around this concept of IQ by any means. Some of us, even if we don't have rocket scientist IQs, are extraordinarily good at dealing with others. Some of us have more empathy or compassion. Some of us are better negotiators or salespeople.
Yep.
Some of us have manual and physical skills. And it's important, even though we're in a knowledge economy, we are not done working in the physical world at all. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'd like to see, and this is coupled to the increased investments in infrastructure, is let's make sure we're doing the training properly so that people have the tools they need, mentally and physical tools, to go repair, you know, the boilers in the schools around the country that are not working very well. We got this aging physical plant. We have a need to fix it. Let's get a core of people out there who've got the tools to get that job done. So, Marty, I hear what you're saying about the people at the bottom of the distribution, but even the people at the bottom of the IQ distribution have a great deal to offer the economy. What we're trying to say in the book is let's create the economic environment that's going to let them find their niche.
Agree completely. And does it not fly in the face of the trend, and indeed President Obama has called to have every student go to college? And that's, you know, as colleges, yes, community colleges do some career training, but there is certainly a significant emphasis on the liberal arts in the general education requirements, even in the courses for to be a manufacturer, a boiler maker. They require you to take advanced math and advanced reading and writing, etc. Is that a call? It has been called elitist and racist to say, well, let's put those bottom half, quote, people into boilermaker careers. Is it realistic to expect in an era where we're so sensitive about categorizing people and closing down their options by not having them go to college, is it realistic to opine that we will do more to provide career and technical education?
Well, then let's change our sensitivities and get past that and give people, again, the options and the tools they need to find their niche. I think I'm like you. I don't like this mantra, which we've been hearing from lots of different people for a long, long time, that the goal of every American kid should be to go to college. I don't think that's correct. I don't think it's appropriate for everybody. I don't think it's useful. And we know that the cost of a classic four-year college education are ballooning. We know that the actual amount of learning is not that great overall, and maybe we're stuffing that channel with people who'd be better served by doing something else with their education.
Sounds great. I'm always listening for this topic can be a very depressing topic because it is scary, as we've outlined, but I always try to where I can realistically balance the realistic pessimism or concerns with realistic optimism. I'd like to move a little bit more on the side of optimism. Where do you find, other than what we've already discussed, some legitimate sources of optimism for the world of work in the next, you're right, not 50 years or 20 years, but over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I characterize myself as a mindful optimist on these topics, meaning I'm aware that we got some serious challenges ahead, but we have proven more than equal to our challenges in the past. And the news that I really want to stress is that the problems we face heading into the future are not problems of not enough to go around, not enough food, not enough clothing, not enough material abundance. That's not the situation that we're facing, and that's unbelievably good news. The question that you're focusing us on is a really, really important one, which is, will there be enough work to go around? And that's the one that I spend a lot of my time scratching my head on. One of the most important things we can do is, as you've pointed out, stop penalizing work so heavily. I think maybe the oldest insight from economics is tax the stuff you want to see less of and subsidize the stuff you want to see more of. Right now, we tax labor. We tax work like crazy. 80% of federal revenues come from either income taxes or payroll taxes. So as you've pointed out, the burden on an employer looking to hire an additional person, that burden is a pretty heavy burden in the financial sense and every sense. One of our more far-out recommendations is, can we rethink that a lot to make it more attractive for an employer to do human labor versus digital labor? And there are some fixes or some changes to the tax code that can make a big difference there.
Well, I imagine many, and I know we can talk about the land tax, for example, in a moment. Many of my listeners say, that's outrageous. We live in an area, in an era of such great income inequality, we need to soak the rich more, and even the upper middle class more. When there are so many people in poverty, they would say we should tax the wealthy and corporation, we should raise the corporate income tax, we should raise rich people's income taxes in order to balance that outrageous income inequality. And you're saying lower the taxes on employers. How can you say that?
Well, because then what they'll do is hire more of those entry-level people. It'll make it more attractive for them to hire somebody at a lower level of skill or education as opposed to trying to send that job to India or trying to send it right into Silicon. You mentioned tax rates on the top earners. The research that I've looked at works really hard to find a correlation between how hard those folk work and how heavily they're taxed. And that correlation, if it exists, is a really, really weak correlation. So could we ratchet up the tax rates on our top earners without making them, you know, take their ball and go home? Yes, we absolutely could. And maybe we should think about raising those rates a bit. The main thing, though, to keep in mind is that even if we were to, use your phrase, and soak the rich and tax them very heavily, we have such a big economy, and the rich are very, very wealthy, but they're just not that great in number, that if we redistributed that income, it would not magically solve all of our problems. Now, I'm not saying that we should idolize the rich and never tax them and don't make them angry in any way. That's not my point at all. My point is just a math one.
Well, I want to say one more. I'm speaking for the I've had this show for 25 years, so I've listened to so many of my listeners. So I want to just try out one more of the arguments that they would make in this situation, a prototypical modal argument, which is, you're making the typical Reagan trickle down assumption that the rich, if we didn't tax them as much, they would invest it in hiring more people. You know what they would do? They would redistribute it to their rich shareholders. They put in their fat pockets and buy more yachts, and in the poor. Yeah, they'll hire only the poor they can and pay them as little as they can get away with as few benefits as they can. You're just wanting to keep money in rich people's pockets. What would you say?
I'm making a different argument. Maybe I was misheard by your prototypical listener.
Or
if
me.
If we took the rich and we taxed them 20% more or 20% less, it would not make any difference in what they actually do. My point is that if we tax them more and redistribute it down to the middle and the bottom, we have a big country. The middle and the bottom is so big that it would not make a huge difference in their lives. It would not solve our low income problems.
Now, rather than speak for my listenership, I'd like to give my listenership a chance to at least one or two calls. We've tried to cover this question about the future of jobs in an ever more technological era, both for implications for people who are highly skilled, highly able, as well as other folks, from the micro to the macro. If you have a comment or question on what has been said, I invite you to call now. My guest is Andrew McAfee. He is from MIT School of Business, a principal research scientist, and the author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. The phone number, if you have a question for him, the phone number at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the real the changes that certainly is occurring in the way in which employers and employees are matched are job websites. I'm not talking about the old monster.com or CareerBuilder, but jobs that it's websites that focus on small, discrete projects like Mechanical Turk, which is an Amazon company, or TaskRabbit, or Odesk. Aren't those, and again, forgive me for continuing to take the classic liberal NPR position here, but aren't those worldwide races to the bottom? I mean, the competition for who gets the task is worldwide, so the pay ends up being bad. So even skilled people, like there's somebody right now who's creating a doodle whiteboard video for me, they're not going to make a middle-class income from doing the work that they're doing for people like me, and they get no benefits, not even a scintilla of job security. And, of course, the employers generally don't pay payroll taxes. So are these project work websites part of the solution or part of the problem?
I think they're part of the solution. They're, as you say, this is different and in many ways inferior to good old-fashioned industrial-era full-time employment with benefits and health care and all that. Yeah, it's contract work, and as the supply of contractors around the world facilitated by technology goes up, the wages are going to go down. Absolutely, that is true. The reason I still like it is because it is a ladder toward something better if it's done correctly, but even more fundamentally, it's giving people work. And there's this kind of wishful thinking that if we shut all of these kinds of crowdsourcing sites down, that employers would have no choice except to hire all these same people at full-time employment. That's just absolutely not what's going to go on. So these things are a fact of life. They're here to stay. What I would say instead is if we're unhappy with the wages they're being paid, but we also think that work is important, and I think work is tremendously important both for individuals and communities, mm-hmm. then why don't we flip what we're doing around, and instead of using a positive income tax above some threshold income level, why don't we have a negative income tax below that income tax level, so that every dollar you make below that cutoff actually earns you, $1.30, $1.40, whatever. That sounds like a crazy socialist idea. It was actually advocated by that noted pinko Milton Friedman
right.
a long time ago. And my co-author, Eric Brynjolfsson, and I really think that's an idea that we need to revisit and think about seriously.
I completely agree.
If we want to encourage work, and we really do want to encourage work, then we need to let these different kinds of technology platforms flourish. And if we're unhappy with the incomes they offer, we have ways to deal with that.
I completely agree, because all of them, as we all know, means-tested things like welfare, it is so subject to fraud and so much paperwork. If we simply gave everybody, by virtue of being human being, a living amount of wage, that ultimately that serves both redistributive functions, avoids a lot more fraud, and allows the benefits that really do accrue from these work websites. Remember that one of the kind of redistributions that occur from a Mechanical Turk or a TaskRabbit or Odesk or any online site is that people all over the world are able to compete. And I am not somebody who is a chauvinist who has any particular affiliation with the United States of America. I am grateful for a lot of things about it, but I do feel as much solidarity with a human being who lives in Bangladesh as somebody who lives in Bakersfield. And that person, without a Mechanical Turk or Odesk, is never going to be able to get the job from me in America. The person I hired to do the doodle videos lives in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. That person, that $10 an hour or $12 or $15, whatever it ended up, that person ended up paying that person, is more like $20 actually, but that's a fortune for that person. That person making $20 an hour dramatically changes that person's quality of life.
And what's amazing to me is, as you say, these platforms are global. They are clearly giving us access to workers all over the world. Globalization has been going on for decades and just accelerating, and yet the labor market in the United States has not absolutely collapsed. As you pointed out, there are some worrying trends. We're not in a great place, but we don't have 50% unemployment, even though the world has opened up and technology has opened up. Our system is astonishingly dynamic and resilient. Eric and I spend two chapters on policy recommendations. They're all about trying to preserve and increase this dynamism and resilience and let the innovators do their work. And before we start jumping into crazy, utopian, dystopian, communist kinds of wealth equalization solutions, before we get there, why don't we see how robust our system is to what it's going through right now?
All our lines immediately lit up as soon as I gave out the phone number, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with my guest, Andrew McAfee, the author of Second Machine Age. What is your question or comment for him?
Hi, I'm on the air.
You are.
Good. Yes, I just wanted to, you're talking about the careers that are slow to be automated or replaced by digital technology. I'm a hotel concierge, and I just want to give a shout-out to the hotel and tourism hospitality industry, because those are mostly jobs that you have to interact with people and can't really be automated and tend to be higher-paying, especially if they're ones where you earn tips, like servers and bellmen and that sort of thing. And I think we've seen, I know when I go to the supermarket and I see the automated checkout stands, that the lines are always longer for the humans, the human checkers. Yeah, and I just think that maybe it's easier, and sometimes I see some, young yuppie guys use it just to, get their two things and go. But most people, I feel, just once you have a real human being to interact with in those situations.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the call, because we have so little time. Any comments? Should we go get and take another call? Because he basically just had
Yeah, I like that comment a lot, and I have been so thankful, for example, for a good hotel concierge once in a while, and I don't see that job being automated, because they interact with me, and then they go ping their human network really hard to help me with my problem. Again, even in this world of astonishing technological progress, I don't see that going away anytime soon.
Fair enough. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Andrew McAfee from MIT and the author of The Second Machine Age. What's your question or comment for him? Hello, it's you.
Hello, am I on the air?
You are.
I'd like to get your feedback. Obviously, robots will take a larger and larger role, but I think the radical thing that's going to both remove a lot of jobs but also challenge manufacturing is 3D printing. That's going to be radical in a way that I don't think Americans are ready for. It's going to provide a lot of opportunities for folks to start their own business. So things that are now made in China can be made in Union City, California. So I'd like to get your feedback as to and your thoughts around 3D printing and the changes we're going to see in the future.
Great question. Andrew.
Yeah, that's a topic for an entire show in itself. And the future of that technology is really uncertain. It's going to be somewhere between a big deal and a really gosh darn hairy huge deal. I mean, don't know where it is on that spectrum. But what I do expect is it's going to continue the trend that we see in the manufacturing industry, not just in the U.S., this is important to stress, but around the world, where year after year, the size of the manufacturing industry increases. Output goes up, value added goes up, and the employment in manufacturing goes down. There are fewer people working year after year around the world in manufacturing. That is purely an automation, a technology, a productivity story. 3D printing is going to continue that story.
Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with my wonderful guest, Andrew McAfee, the author of The Second Machine Age. What's your comment or question for him?
Is that me?
It is.
Yeah. Hello. I'm an eighth grade science teacher in Oakland, and a lot of my students are on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, and I'm wondering, what do you think the most important thing I should be teaching them right now to help them get it?
Great question. Andrew?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, keep up the good work. The research is really clear, and I'm going to assume you're a good teacher. The research is really clear that the impact of a good teacher on a classroom of students is astonishingly large. So one of our recommendations has to do with attracting and retaining really good people into the profession of teaching. To try to answer your question specifically, the main thing I would encourage you to help your students do is learn not just to solve problems, but learn to love solving problems. I was a Montessori kid for the earliest years of my education, and I'm incredibly grateful, because what that education taught me, and it was a complete hippie school of education, but I loved it because it taught me that the world is a really interesting place, and my job is to go explore it and poke at it and learn more about it. Thank heaven.
Great. Well, I appreciate your call very much. We have just about a minute or two left. Give me a quick take. You know, one of the aspects of jobs that you did write about in the book that we haven't talked about is H-1B visa programs. And again, forgive me for trying to just sound like a typical liberal, but you argue that the program should be expanded. Activists in the Bay Area argue that we have plenty of good Americans to do tech jobs, and the only reason for H-1B visas is to enable corporations to get more compliant, cheap foreign labor. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I just don't agree with that. We've got a ton of research. It is very clear. Immigration is a net positive for the country that receives them. We have got many of the world's smartest, best trained, most ambitious people trying to beat down our doors and come to our country to start their businesses and to contribute here, and we're making it difficult for them. That honestly makes no sense to me. And the research is also pretty clear that immigration does not lead to job loss or reduced opportunities for the native. So I just don't buy that argument.
Okay, and the last question. Think back on our, we've spent an hour together, which is, as I've said many times here, it's been a privilege for me. I've really enjoyed it. What's one thing that we either haven't said that you want to say to my listenership about the future and present and future of work, or something you want to reemphasize?
The main point I want to reemphasize is this idea of mindful optimism, that we are heading into a future that is going to be more bountiful, more abundant, more options. We're going to live longer, healthier lives. The old joke is that technological progress is the only free lunch that economists believe in. We have a great big lunch being served to us right now. And if we fumble this by getting the distribution wrong, or because we can't give people their right slice of the pie, shame on us. We can get this right.
Well, you certainly got this interview just right, and I seriously mean it. If you would like to appear back on the show, email me a list of topics that you'd like to talk about, including the 3D printing, and we will have you back on. It was great having you on, Andrew McAfee.
Marty, that's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, the book is The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. I commend it to you, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, as always, Joanne Marr, who I really appreciate. She always listens very carefully to the show, and that is a privilege. It really matters a lot to me. And I want to, of course, thank all of you for listening. Your call-in questions were fabulous. They were intelligent and added immeasurably to the interview. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And while I was at a stoplight, as is increasingly the case, there was a sad-looking person with a cardboard sign asking for money. I rolled down the window, and as I gave him a buck, I asked him why he was wearing a Cal Berkeley hat. On the next Work with Marty Nemco, he's going to tell you his story. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.